Thank you very much. One of the things I pride myself on, and that's a terrible word, is my ability to divide any audience. Male, female, secular, religious, denominational, you name it. So I would just like to pick up on something that Tim said earlier when he was speaking about the US Marines and the role of honour. Well, about 2.5 years ago, I had the privilege of going to Fort Leavenworth, the American Army Staff College. So there was 150 majors on their staff course and 50 senior American, mainly Army officers, and a handful of us academics. And the conference was on developing a professional military ethic. And early on, so the sole Air Force links were myself, civilian, former chaplain, former officer in the Air Force as well, and teaching at the RAF College, an Italian officer, Air Force, a French Air Force officer, and a Marine Air Force, a Marine pilot. So those are the only people with a flying link. And one of the American three-star generals put a matrix on the screen that showed every branch of their armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, Air National Guard, and I think maybe even CIA. And then on the horizontal plane, they put all the core values. And they made a big play of the fact that every organization in the US Armed Forces, except for the Air Force, had honor as one of its core values. And 200 odd people laughed, so I put my hand up. This is true. 200 people laughed. I put my hand up. They said, "Sir, can you introduce yourself?" And I said, "Yes, Peter Lee, Royal Air Force College, Carnarvon, UK." Can I just say, the reason for that is Air Force officers don't need to have it spelt out for them. So anyway, on to more serious bits. Completely unrelated, I just thought that would be a good way to divide the audience. On to more serious business of military intervention in the 21st century. I will start by saying a bit more about myself and where I'm coming from. On a serious note, that helps you to weigh up what I'm saying and factor in my personal biases, of which there are many. On the other hand, if I tell you where I'm coming from and what I think, that you can go straight to a summary judgment, which is what we do, and it'll save you listening and making your judgment later on. So in terms of where I'm coming from, I was a chaplain in 2003 when the Iraq War started. The last thing I did before I was sent to Cyprus, a couple of weeks after Taliban 1 started, I sadly was involved in the kinforming for one of the Tornado crew that was shot down by an American Patriot missile. And then I went out, spent 5 months at the bedside of the wounded, injured, maimed, sick from the Iraq theatre. I am grossly squeamish. I don't like watching casualty or Hobie or medical drama on TV. And every day I was confronted with 2 to 3 dozen new arrivals from theatre, many of whom were waking up having previously lost consciousness in the middle of something, and then woke up in Cyprus, limbs missing, faces melted, all the things that happen. And I was being asked, and it was disproportionately Scots at the time, because the Black Watch, with whom Alan was associated and through whom we met, they had gone to Camp Dogwood. They were taking lots of casualties. So people with accents, actually even thicker than my own, were asking questions like, "Padre, should we be at war? Should Blair have sent us? Should I have been launching shells into that compound when women and children were running out the side?" And others saying things like, can I go back, Padre?" "Well, you've lost a leg, so possibly not." Others with vomiting and diarrhea because they couldn't clean their mess tins properly. "Padre, will this get me back to Britain?" "No, you bullet dodger. Get back to where you belong." Those kind of fairly harsh discussions took place on a regular basis. Oh, excuse me, my computer just did something. It was only there for some quotes. I'll just have to cuff it and make them what I think they were rather than what they actually were. So in terms of my coming to ethics and ethics of war, it is not some abstract, detached entity for me. I came to it in a hospital that I can still smell if I shut my eyes, with people who will never be the same, and as a result of them never be the same, I'll never be the same. And it's deeply personal. And I have very strong feelings about Mr. Blair, and I'll say something about my book, which is Iraq and the Illusion of Morality. That's the subtitle. Blair's Just War, Iraq and the Illusion of Morality. My concern or argument per se is not that Iraq was or was not just. My argument is Blair's use of moral arguments to justify his case was illusory, which is slightly different. I had a far greater regard and respect for George Bush's arguments, which are very candid, very brutal, very realist. We are changing regime. We are getting rid of that guy. No obfuscating, no pretending that the UN actually meant anything to him. This is what we're doing. The rest was flower dressing. Blair was trying to circle a square of his own choosing. That's my most critical points about Tony Blair. I will say one or two more positive things about him in a minute. So that's how I got into the subject, and I do teach at the Air Force College, and as someone has I've discussed with someone else already, ethics was only introduced to the RAF Cranwell syllabus in 2005. When I trained as a chaplain in 2001 and as an officer in 1988, ethics was not part of the military syllabus, the RAF syllabus. Events in and around Iraq prompted this to be included. Events like Abu Ghraib prompted it to be included. And I was approached, and so for 6 years now I've been doing that, and I love that aspect of the job. I get excited every day I go in because it truly is a life and death business, and if we can't hold a mirror up to the young men and women who are going to be conducting this life and death business and ask the awkward questions, then we are failing them, and they will ultimately either be damaged or fail themselves. As I turn to look at military intervention in the 21st century from Iraq to Syria, I'm looking particularly from a British perspective, but although that has to be seen in conjunction with US foreign policy as well. And I'm, having said what I said about Tony Blair, I'm actually going to use some of Blair's words as a lens through which to look at the various interventions. And I'm going to start with something that's been mentioned twice already, and that is his 1999 Chicago speech. And I'm going to, I don't have my own notes here. I deliberately came to hopefully build on things or address things that have been raised earlier. And I'm going to use Nigel's opening sheet with the six just war criteria on. I'll use that shortly. So if it's to hand, it will be helpful in this talk as well. And just, I'll almost give a conclusion now, having given all that preamble. Interesting quote from Palmerston earlier about there only being one enduring interest, that national self-interest, if you want to put it that way. I'm going to suggest, in the context of speaking about military intervention in the 21st century from Iraq to Syria, that 1999 to 2011 was the British and probably the American liberal interventionist period. I'm going to suggest, and I've, in a book that is with the publisher right now, I have written this down, because I don't mind looking like an idiot in the future if I get that wrong, because I believe it, so I'll say it. I think we have just lived through the British liberal interventionist period, which was prompted by Blair and that value-driven sense of globalism that he talked about in 1999. I think that has ended. Syria is the nail in that coffin. Now I'll try and justify that. Back in 1999... and if this magically appears, I think it was just rebooting itself for some reason. In 1999, Tony Blair gave a speech in Chicago on the 24th of April. And he was primarily concerned with NATO, really. He was looking at NATO's 50th anniversary. The war in Kosovo, sorry, the war over Kosovo, had been ongoing for a month. What was originally envisaged to be a 2 or 3 day intervention, Madeleine Albright, you know, we'll send some aircraft over and Milosevic will capitulate and stop this ethnic cleansing of the Kosovars. Well, actually, after 3 days, Milosevic probably hadn't stopped laughing at that point, so that plan didn't really work so well initially. Then there was an incremental increase in the use of air power until it became quite an overwhelming and staggering use of air power, which ultimately, together with severe political pressure from Russia, eventually, threats of boots on the ground from armies various, brought negotiation about. So with that context, or a bit of background, very crude, Blair offered some thoughts on how this new internationalism was his phrase, how this new internationalism should be seen and how it should work, and how civilized, advanced nations, it's kind of neo-colonialist talk almost, because he meant Western nations, let's be blunt, how new, in this new internationalist environment, we should be willing and able to intervene on behalf of oppressed people, and Kosovo was one such. And he offered five phrases in five questions in this. Now, just another caveat, these were not actually written by Tony Blair, they were written by Professor Lawrence Friedman. 2 weeks before this, Blair's office approached Lawrence Friedman, professor at King's College London, and said, Prime Minister's giving a speech on this new internationalism, what would it look like, why, when should we intervene militarily? Lawrence Friedman wrote 6 pages, say four. Tony Blair put an introduction and conclusion on the end and used it. And just to show you how British politics works, about 3 years, 4 years later, around the time of the Iraq War, Tony Blair nominated Lawrence Friedman for a knighthood, so he's now Sir Professor Lawrence, or Professor Sir Lawrence. And then some years after the fact, when the Iraq Inquiry was constituted by Gordon Brown, they thought, we need a historian on the Iraq Inquiry. Let's call upon Lawrence Friedman, the man who wrote Blair's interventionist policy, to sit on a panel that judges the Iraq War. I just show you that as a little bit of interesting how things work in the UK. I pass no judgment on Lawrence Friedman, but I did write to Sir John Chilcot pointing out this fact, and 48 hours later, two letters appeared on the Iraq Inquiry website, which are still there, both from Friedman to Sir John Chilcot, saying, Dear Sir John, you and the public might like to know that back in 1999, I wrote this thing for Tony Blair. And here, in the second one, here's a copy of it. That's why we know Blair's speech is word for word what was written for him. A little bit of historical stuff. What was said that is so interesting for me is this. Here are some excerpts taken word for word about when we should intervene to save oppressed. And by that I mean people undergoing ethnic cleansing, genocide, extreme abuses at the hand of the political leaders. Tony Blair said, are we sure of our case? Have we exhausted all diplomatic options? I've excised a few words, but these words are exact and they're in context. Are there military options that we can sensibly and prudently undertake? Are we prepared for the long term? And do we have national interests involved? I'll just say them quickly again. Are we sure of our case? Have we exhausted all diplomatic options? Are there military options we can sensibly and prudently undertake? Are we prepared for the long term? And do we have national interests involved? I'm going to suggest, and I do this in my book and elsewhere, that these parallel very closely, not perfectly, but very closely, many of the just war criteria which Nigel has earlier outlined to us and are on your sheet. Just cause, are we sure of our case? That seems perfectly reasonable. Have we exhausted all diplomatic options? That, I would suggest, equates fairly well to last resort. Have we tried everything reasonably that we could otherwise do? Are there military options we can sensibly and prudently undertake? Is there a reasonable prospect of success? Are we prepared for the long term? I think this is a proportionality issue. Will the good that come out of this outweigh the evil that's done in the process in some way, shape or form? And lastly, this thing, do we have national interests involved? And I thought Nigel gave a very good, I'm going to take some of those ideas away with me, exposition of that notion earlier. This one doesn't fit so naturally within the just war criteria, but it does throw up the question of intention. What would our intention be in intervening? It was mentioned earlier, I have never made the argument that the United States went to war with Iraq for oil, for example. I don't think it did. I think it's helpful that it perhaps released a bit more of the oil into the global market, but I don't think theft or misappropriation was ever part of the American or British justification. With that said, a US congressman famously noted, and the detail will be in my book, he said, let's face it, if they grew carrots, we wouldn't be there. So I just offer that by counterpoint to my own comments about, I don't think it was about oil, but I think that's part of what are the national interests. So I think Blair set up very good criteria for military intervention in 1999. And how good are those criteria? Ironically, they are almost word for word the same criteria that were proposed in 2001 by a commission, ISIS, ICISS, not the one that's been attacking Iraq and Syria. It's an international commission, and the name's just gone out of my head, but it was a commission put together by the Secretary General of the United Nations and led by the Canadian government to propose what would become a framework for R2P, responsibility to protect. And they proposed 6 criteria. They are exactly the criteria Nigel wrote down for you earlier for judging when a military intervention should take place. And in a typical diplomatic fudge, when R2P was pronounced official in 2005 at the United Nations World Summit, they were excluded completely and have been formally excluded from every R2P doctrine document produced by the United Nations ever since. Number of reasons for that. One of the main ones being they are so associated with a Western tradition of thought that it's just offensive to other parts of the world. And secondly, because those words and language have been used by Blair and Bush for their interventions, they are seen as damaged goods in justifying interventions under responsibility to protect. Now, I might come back to that later when we think about Syria as the challenge of the day. So Blair set out what I think are very sound and historically grounded criteria for military intervention on humanitarian grounds. Then we had Syria, then we had Sierra Leone in 2000, that was mentioned earlier, and I think that was a fascinating small-scale intervention and a successful small-scale intervention, by which point Blair is very convinced of his own moral authority. If you read his biography, it's fascinating. Afghanistan comes along. That's a different kettle of fish, but it's in response to 9/11, and Blair made an instant strategic decision that the United Kingdom is going to stand shoulder to shoulder with the United States. While they remove this evil from the world, was the phrase. This was not while we deal with this terrorist problem. While we remove this evil from the world. Blair and Bush both using similar language, apocalyptic language. People often ask, and it's disputed, that when Blair signed in blood that the United Kingdom was going to go to war with the United States. And there's much speculation that it took place 4th, 6th of April 2002 at Camp David. No, it took place on 9/11. The day that Blair said, we will stand shoulder to shoulder while we rid the world of this evil, he personally and the United Kingdom nationally could not back out without great humiliation. That's when Blair committed us, and it's naive to think otherwise. In his own reflections on that period in the build-up to the Iraq War, Tony Blair wrote this in his biography. He just didn't understand why everybody was so hung up on the legal case. He said, we didn't have it for Kosovo, and his words, we did not even think about it for Sierra Leone, so why are they bothered about it now? His view in his book, and he describes how, for him, he said to the House of Commons Liaison Committee in July 2003, what were his key considerations when considering going to war? He said, is it right and is it doable? A moral judgment followed by all the pragmatic bits under which fell the legal aspect. Can we legally justify it? So by 2003, I'm going to argue, and I have argued at length in my book and elsewhere, that Blair began to ignore his own criteria for military intervention. I mentioned George Bush's position. There was a press conference at Camp David on the 4th of April 2002, and an American journalist said, joint press conference with the President and our Prime Minister, and an American journalist said, Mr. President, what is your intention with regard to Iraq and Saddam Hussein? And he said, we are going to get rid of that guy. The transcripts are available. We are going to get rid of that guy. We are changing regime. A switched on British journalist turned and said, Prime Minister, is that the British approach? And Tony Blair said, let me be clear, which we all know is political code for I'm about to lie my face off. Let me be clear. It has always been the position of the British government the policy. It has always been the policy of the British government that Iraq would be a better place without Saddam Hussein. It has always been the policy of the British government that Iraq would be a better place without Saddam Hussein. Now, that may be an opinion or an aspiration. The last thing that is a policy. George Bush then realises that he has dumped his partner in it, because our Attorney General has told Tony Blair, regime change is illegal under international law. You cannot use that as a justification for going to war. So George Bush, in a moment of great self-awareness, of which he was not famed, said, "Oh dear, I seem to have made things a bit tricky for the Prime Minister. I must be a bit more nuanced in what I say." There's a fundamental difference. Bush had a firm policy. He had congressional support. He didn't need anybody to do this, but he wanted political partners. It makes sense to have a coalition politically. Tony Blair, however, had to wrestle with a political party of his own that, by and large, was not overwhelmingly supportive and perhaps on balance was against the war. British public opinion always pivoted around the 50% mark. And he had an Attorney General that told him the humanitarian argument won't work right now. Thank you very much. The humanitarian atrocities against the Kurds were 12 years ago. And regime change doesn't work. So the Attorney General had cut off his key arguments, leaving him with WMD. Weapons of mass destruction. In the background, as these things are being said in public, and he said a number of times to Parliament, weapons of mass destruction is our reason for going to war. He said it on the eve of war, he said it a few months afterwards to the Liaison Committee. Our basis for going to war is weapons of mass destruction. In private, however, let me just read from a memo between him and Jonathan Powell, and this is dated 19th July 2002. So at the time when in public he's saying WMD is our reasons, in the memo states, "We need a roadmap to getting rid of Saddam." Right? "We need a roadmap to getting rid of Saddam." Several paragraphs further down, "We need to establish a legal base." Because getting rid of Saddam is at the top of the page. Now, in my logic, that tends to me to suggest that the stuff at the top of the page is what they're going to do, and the stuff afterwards is how they're going to achieve it. It's kind of how service papers are written. I did defence writing. I lived it. I got better than a C, so I let down all the aircrew guys. But that's how it works. I got an aircrew A. No, I got better than an aircrew A. It says, "It's more difficult for us than the Americans. It needs to be based on WMD rather than terrorism or regime change." So getting rid of Saddam is what he's going to do, and we need to establish a legal base. Now, I was quite proud to have that some years ago because someone slipped it to me, but now it's declassified and you can get it on the Iraq website, the Iraq Inquiry website. So in public he's saying, our reason for going to war is WMD. In private, our reason for going to war is to be with the Americans and getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And I can show you lots of speeches and other documents that have been released, absolutely support the intention, going back to the just war arguments, was regime change. WMD was what they needed to say in order to get votes through Parliament, get British public support, etc. I just mentioned a quote from Robin Cook's resignation speech. He resigned on the eve of war and gave what was reckoned to be one of the great ministerial resignation speeches of the 20th century. Of the last 100 years, because it was early in the 21st century. And he said, "You cannot," and we've got lots of military people in general here, "you cannot say to the armed forces," because there's an issue about holding back their preparations, "we can't be seen to be doing too much," despite the defence review saying that to fight a medium-sized campaign, the British armed forces needed 6 months to prepare. They're holding back. So Robin Cook said, "You cannot tell the armed forces, oh, you only need this much kit and this much money because it's not going to be too bad." While on the other side saying to the country and the world, "He's got WMD, he's going to destroy his neighbours, he's a great threat." He's either no threat or he's a great threat, but you're trying to ride both horses, and until you give me consistency, I cannot be part of your government. And that was somebody who was close to him, although not absolutely in the inner circle, of course. Just one or two other uncomfortable points at that time. dodgy dossier of September 2002. I've got a copy. Obviously, everyone can get a copy. I have a copy of the unused last page, which again was declassified for Chilcot. And I'll read it out, but it looks much better on paper instead of the screen, but I'll read it out. And it's got, this is unused last page, and it's got chemical and biological weapons, and next to it, weapons available include bombs, airborne spray, artillery shells, rockets, ballistic missile warheads. Some weapons could be deployed within 45 minutes of an order. Right, listen. Weapons available include bombs, airborne sprays, artillery shells, rockets, and ballistic missile warheads. Some weapons could be deployed within 45 minutes of an order. You're allowed one question. I did this with my daughter when she was 12. What's your one question you want to ask about that?
Which ones?
Which ones? Exactly. Funnily enough, my 12-year-old said the same thing. Which ones? This conclusion was dropped off. Alistair Campbell was chairing the group that put the dossier together. This conclusion was withdrawn. Again, it's available on the Iraq Inquiry site. It's been declassified. My challenge, my problem with Blair is this, and the system more generally, but him in particular. If he read that and did not ask the question, what weapons can be deployed in 45 minutes, then he was incompetent as a Prime Minister, and there should be some opprobrium for that. If he was not shown it by Alistair Campbell or anyone else because they did not want him to ask the question and therefore have plausible deniability, there's corruption at the heart of our government and our security processes, and there should be opprobrium for that. If he read it and was too stupid to ask the question, there should be opprobrium for that as well. Either way, somehow that ended up being left off the dossier that went in the House of Commons library. And that thing about 45 minutes, if there's one thing I hope comes out of the Iraq inquiry, it is the restoration of the reputation of Andrew Gilligan. Now, he talked about sexing up the dossier. I think he got his wording wrong. The dossier was dumbed down. When you leave that information off, you're not giving Parliament or the British people everything you know. Even if what you know is just another question, it's a really important question. So, I'll labour that. I think the last thing I'll mention is a very important letter by Elizabeth Wilmshurst, whose name you may or may not remember. She was one of the two most senior international lawyers in the Foreign Commonwealth Office. Her and her boss were both of the view that on the 18th of March 2003, if the UK took part in an attack on Iraq without a further UN authorisation, we would be committing the crime of aggression in international law. She resigned on principle. He, the boss, stayed because he didn't want to leave Jack Straw in it. And the way I describe it, because Jack Straw has said, everybody knows that there were serious consequences, UN Security Council Resolution 1441. There'll be serious consequences if Saddam doesn't comply. Serious consequences is the term they used. That's what I threaten my daughter with if she doesn't come back on time. If you're not in by 11 o'clock, there'll be serious consequences. Yeah, Dad. In the international system and international diplomacy, it means nothing. The phrase that means everything is, all means necessary. That is a diplomatic language for war. We got it for Libya, all means necessary, from the air. I'll mention that again. We had it in 1991, all means necessary to remove Iraqi forces from Kuwait. It was actually achieved in Korea as well, through a strange combination of circumstances at the UN Security Council. The phrase all means necessary was not included in Security Council Resolution 1441 in November 2002 because the Russians and Chinese and French would not allow an automatic trigger to war. The Americans and British wanted one. The phrase serious consequences let everybody say we've got something. So the Russians, French and Chinese said, there, we've won the diplomatic battle, we've not included the clause for war. And the Americans and British said, hey, the serious consequences, of course that means war. Again, and I just to double check, I happened to meet at a conference last week, Chief of the Air Staff's conference, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, United Nations Ambassador to the UN at that time. So I collared him afterwards and I said, can I ask you a question? What does serious consequences mean versus all means necessary? And he just laughed and he said, good point, well made, I won't answer it, you're right. And he said, the phrase he used in 2004 and repeated last week in his presentation was, Iraq is an example of legality, kind of, without legitimacy. I would say, looking back, Kosovo was one where you had legitimacy without legality, strictly speaking, as in UN Security Council authorised. So just summing up this bit before I say a little bit more about Syria, we had all these criteria, just cause, right intention, proportionality, and in my book I've gone through and I argue the case that Blair tried to produce a case under each of these, and I argue that it's an illusion, that it did not stand up, and that 10 years, 12 years later, it does not stand up. I like to think public opinion is very heavily in my favour, and I think the Iraq inquiry, I am confident the Iraq inquiry will not produce anything that undermines my basic argument. Don't know what it will produce. What about Blair? Where is he? Well, one of the most telling things that he has ever said, and I cannot believe the press did not pick up on this, was December, I think it was either 2010 or 11, when he was appearing a couple of weeks before he appeared at the Iraq inquiry. He was interviewed by Fearne Britton. You know the TV presenter? Everyone thinks of Fearne as an affable, cheerful lady, very friendly, does morning TV, and forget she was a hard-nosed journalist for 20 years. Knows how to answer a question, and she suckered them with the Nixon question. And she said, Mr. Blair, knowing what you know now, that there were no WMD in Iraq, would you still have gone ahead? And he said, he ummed and awed a bit. And he said, what you've got to understand is, it was right to get rid of him. I would just have had to have framed my arguments differently. There were no other arguments he could use. The Attorney General had cut them all off. Regime change? No. Humanitarian? At that time didn't apply. The atrocities had happened 12 years earlier. It was like Kosovo, where you saw every night Kosovars being moved out of the country, or as we're seeing every night in Syria now. If he had argued the national interest, a realist case, and said, I believe, back in 2002-03, the world would be better, the Middle East would be better without Saddam Hussein, I would probably have still been supporting him today. It was the fundamental dishonesty that offended me then, it offends me now. But that doesn't matter, because who am I? I'm just another British citizen who's a bit opinionated and likes to think about these things. Does it matter, actually? I don't matter. The principle matters, because I believe most of the UK thinks they were at least a bit misled, and at most downright lied to, and I can give you at least one absolute 100%, 180 degree lie that I've got them out on. But I genuinely think underneath it all, the problem was he truly believed in his own personal moral authority, in his own inherent rightness. Read his book and tell me otherwise. And again, that doesn't really matter, except that because so many of the British public and a large number of British military personnel were sceptical of his reasoning and arguments, etc., he has left the current Prime Minister and every subsequent Prime Minister over the next probably a generation or more hamstrung. Because I've said this a couple of years ago, then Syria's turned up, and I will turn to Syria now, because if he wants to take the country to war, if David Cameron wants to take the country to war, he's almost going to have to publish raw intelligence on the front page of the Sun and allow the public to make their mind up. Because everything that's been filtered through government and the military and intelligence agencies will be met sceptically. Now let's move ahead to Syria, and I'll say a couple of things about Syria. Because I may come back to Libya if there's time, but I think Syria is an important one. Because if we look at Tony Blair's own criteria for war, for military intervention, back in 1999, are we sure of our case? Have we exhausted all diplomatic options? Are there military options we can sensibly undertake, and so on? His criteria hold up very well. Problem is, he undermined them with Iraq. Are we sure of our case? Well, I don't think the British public are sure of the case that Tony put to them for Iraq. Are we sure of our case in Syria? I'm damn sure that in Syria there have been use of chemical weapons. Pretty confident it was nearly all the government's work, but there's a possibility that the opposition could acquire some and use it as well. Have 2.5 million people at least been displaced externally and millions more internally? Yes. The UN stopped their official headcount about 18 months ago when they reached about 100,000 because it was getting so dangerous to try and acquire figures. But the UN, and I'll take them, they're pretty confident deaths in Syria have been at least 150,000. So actual use of chemical weapons, 150,000 dead very recently. We've watched it happening. All sorts of other atrocities going on. Displacements, complete destabilization of the region, the rise of ISIS and everything. Are we sure that there's a case for getting involved? I would say just a smidgen, probably. I think we might want to be interested. What are our intentions? I think a UK government with allies could legitimately intervene in Syria simply on the humanitarian grounds of saving Syrian lives. There's not a lot of oil interest or other natural resource interest in Syria. I think when David Cameron was putting forward his case last August, that British intentions were noble. So just cause, yes. Right intention on part of the British government, yes. I went on dozens of radio interviews and argued that we should stay out of Syria. Still think we should stay out of Syria. Using just war criteria and Blair's own arguments for intervention because of this. Are there military options we can sensibly and prudently undertake? So my comment on all the radio interviews that I did, because I had written something for a newspaper, the interviews went like this. Should Britain get involved in Syria? I said no. There's clearly a reason why we should, and we can do so with good intention. But unless our politicians can specify a desired political end state, that's one thing, and secondly, say specifically how that political end state is to be achieved militarily, and those two things together are known as strategy, a complete lack of which we have seen over the last 15 years. Unless you have those two things, and by the way, if anyone's sceptical about that comment, oh, we've not seen strategy, can you sum up in one sentence why we're in Afghanistan? And if you can't, it's been shifting, and if it's shifting, it's not strategy. So I said, you need to be able to articulate the political end state and how military force will get you there. And I believe that when, and this was the day of the vote in Parliament, I said this in the morning and early afternoon, unless, I said, once the learned and wiser members of Parliament discuss these points, I think Parliament will vote against. I wish I was a gambler and put money on it, because Parliament had never voted against a Prime Minister wanting to take this country to use military force. And Parliament narrowly voted against. For 24 hours, I was considered to know something, and then everyone realised you could only fool everyone some of the time. Because there is no easy way. There was talk of us arming the opposition. Well, how much of that official opposition from 2 years ago is now official opposition? And how much has gone over to one of the myriad groups? It is now the mother of all proxy wars. Middle Eastern states, external states, us, Russia. Everyone's got an interest, and the poor Syrians are getting caught in the crossfire. Throw into that a sectarian war which has needed to take place in the Middle East for centuries, but hasn't, between the Shias and the Sunnis. I used an analogy earlier. Some of the tyrants in the Middle East, like Gaddafi, like Assad, like Saddam Hussein, the one thing they have done is kept a lid on things, but it's akin to the teacher. Now, the kind of school I went to, in Woodmill High School, Dunfermline, which has sent more people, my year sent more people into prison system than the university system. And if you didn't join a gang, you had to join the rugby club, because they were the biggest gang. So I joined the rugby club, because I was small. I could run a bit. It was a kind of, I'm not exaggerating when I say it was a rare day in our school where there wasn't a fight. And because we were across the road from St. Columba's Catholic Schools, the rare day when we didn't have a fight with them as well. It's called therapeutic exercise. Other people call it, you know, religious bigotry. Of course not. It's just fighting is what you do. But fight goes on, teacher comes out. You do right, stop doing that. Teacher stands, and the two protagonists stare at one another. And they're thinking, when the teacher's going, you're getting it. Teacher goes inside, 3 seconds later. And so that's all Saddam Hussein has done. That's what Sykes-Picot Agreement. It's 100-year-old artificial divisions. So anything that we're trying to do with Syria, or we could try and do, would be sticking over the plaster, or putting a sticky plaster on a very serious injury. I said I was going to talk about military intervention in the 21st century from Iraq to Syria, and actually Syria probably doesn't belong in there, because I don't think we have, and in the current situation I don't think we will, because the British people have said we will not. And unless circumstances changed. I put out my case at the beginning that I believe the liberal interventionist here is based on value-driven ideology, the force for good, doing good, being good internationalists. I think that period in British history and world history is gone for at least a generation, or until another major catastrophe of the order of 9/11 takes place, either here, Europe, United States. I think we've gone back to a world of realpolitik. The nation state is rising again, and I point, and I've written about this, but I point to the recent European elections. Nationalism has swept across Europe. It's not the predominant force, but it is now a significant force that was absent for decades. So I think the world is changing. The world is changing rapidly. I think our values as British people, and there has been a little bit of disputing in the press as to what they are between Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, and Tristram, I've got an expensive education hunt. I do apologise, just throw a little bit of politics in there, but when he went to kind of school I went to hear someone who sounds like him, who is educated like him, speaking on behalf of the downtrodden masses, I'm sorry, I can hardly stop the sick coming up. When there's a discussion about British values, I think we are going through a period of reassessing it. We might not talk about that, but when our public, 89% of whom were against any form of military involvement in Syria back in August, September last year, and you can see it on a number of the polling organisations, 89% were against any form of military intervention. I think that is a reflection on changing British values, or at least the country that's thinking about what are we doing, why are we doing it, should we be doing it. So I think there is a lot of reflection going on. And I think very sadly that Tony Blair's potentially greatest contribution to British foreign policy and indeed global policy on interventionism, that speech in 1999, and the ideas are absolutely front and centre in the R2P responsibility to protect doctrine. He undermined his own case, he undermined the Iraq justification, and he's undermined British trust even more in the political system and in the utility of war as a means of using force to help, using force as a good in the world. And I truly believe it can be and should be. I am not a pacifist, I advocate just war. I would be very surprised if I'm that far from Nigel, actually. The comment, is there a war you didn't like? And that was a disparaging comment, I think, aimed in your direction. Is there a war I don't like? I wouldn't even go as far as to say I didn't like the Iraq war. It was the dishonesty around it I didn't like. If you're going to fight a war, be honest about it. So military intervention in the 21st century, it is a moral minefield. It's a physical minefield as well. It's a moral minefield. It is a political quagmire. And it has left a country, I think, less and less confident about its place in the world in terms of how we should project out into that world, if we should project out into that world. And I think it has left a great deal of uncertainty against which the next strategic defence review is to take place. And I think there are severe questions about how our armed forces return to contingency and training when the national mood is, doesn't matter what the contingencies are, we're not getting involved. So some very severe dilemmas. And all of that, I will pivot around Blair's good and bad applications of some historical ethical arguments. As you know, I could go on forever. I'm going to stop there, and I'm sure there might be one or two questions when we all gather or whatever. There's good reason to say that, because military interventions were carried out earlier in that decade after the Cold War. The reason I say 1999, and it's a very specific value-driven liberal interventionism, so I'm quite specific about that, is because what prompted Blair and Clinton was the failure in Rwanda and the failure in Srebrenica. And Clinton has said Rwanda is the greatest regret of his life and his presidency. That's what changed the motivation into being a value-driven one rather than it's maybe in our interest. And let's be blunt, part of what happened in the Balkans is about NATO finding a reason for being. If I may be so bold, the army going to Helmand in 2006, was there just a touch of we don't use a brigade, we might lose a brigade. I ask that question, it's an uncomfortable question. And by the way, I thoroughly recommend a book called British Generals in Blair's War, so you may have a chapter in it. Yeah. I reviewed it. Fascinating book. Every Prime Minister and Minister should, an MP should read it, as should all military officers. So I think the intervention is a very specific motivation for intervention, and I think it came out of those humanitarian disasters. So question.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, if I can paraphrase the question then, you're asking if, when, with increasing Western reluctance to intervene with military force and with the issuing of threats like Obama's red line over chemical weapons in Syria then not being backed up, are there implications for non-state actors and others in the future? Yes, I think there are major implications. I would throw Crimea at you as an example. I've told some of you here that I was in Geneva about 2 months ago at the Red Cross talking on autonomous weaponry. And there was a 21-state delegation, Russians and Americans. And I offered this thought. This was a major international thing. They might not invite me back. So I said, ethics, on autonomous weapons was, scientists, technologists and all others had said how if you get autonomous weapons, it will give you an inherent military advantage. It will be asymmetrically unfair. I said, completely disagree, completely wrong. Let's look at Crimea. Clausewitz said, war is a clash of wills. It's not a clash of technology, it's a clash of wills. So I pointed out to the American delegation that in Vietnam, their technological superiority had not won that war. And I said, look at Afghanistan, our technological superiority doesn't say to me I'm going to be entirely happy with the outcome when I look back from 10 years' time. I said, but let's look at Crimea right now, at which point the Russian delegation sat up on their seats and stared. I said, look at President Putin on one side and look at President Obama, Prime Minister David Cameron, President Hollande of France, Chancellor Merkel of Germany. Look at those two sides, look at the eyes of those leaders and ask yourself, which has got the greater will to prevail and who do you think is going to prevail? I said, I'm going to offer you no answer to that, I just ask you to think about it. Even the American guys came up to me from the State Department and said, yeah, Putin means it. So is there an implication from the West, not just for non-state actors? If Putin feels that the West is not going to act, then a great amount of deterrence has been lost. Even our unwillingness to step into Syria has told ISIS and other groups that we are not willing to contest the ground. So I think it emboldens enemies. And if the United States, and they are still at war with terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, President Obama has reaffirmed it, they are not foreshortening any war by demonstrating a lack of will to pursue it. Because their enemies, from Vietnam to the present, have learned, their enemies, our enemies, have learned, if they can outweigh us, we'll get fed up and we'll go away.
Yeah. So is there a danger that we're going back to the Westphalian model, that you can do what you like, you know, within your sovereign borders and nobody, you know, has any right to go in and do anything about it?
So yes, are we going back to the Westphalian model and can you do anything with your own sovereign borders? I would not say we're going back there. I'd say that's where we are and have been for a few years. And when Jeremy Greenstock spoke at the Chief of the Air Staff's conference last week, he spoke glowingly of the United Nations, but there's a few problems. So I asked the question publicly, what did he think? And he said some critical things about the Russians. And I asked the question, what do you think has done more to undermine the purposes and institutions of the United Nations? Russian conduct over Crimea or British and American conduct over Iraq 10 years ago? He gave a masterful diplomatic response in not answering the question. The laughter from around the room suggested that there are implications for United Nations, for the Westphalian system, for the United Nations, and how the global system operates. Sadly, I think that tendency towards internationalism that Blair was advocating, and I supported that in the late 90s, I would still support it now if it can be achieved. I think that is being replaced by a return to that Westphalian framework. The Chinese have never moved from it, the Russians have never moved from it, and partly I think it might just be a waking up of the West that are projecting onto the rest of the world what we think the ideal world should look like is not working, and if we're honest, probably has never worked. The rest of the world has just taken a few centuries to tell us so.
Okay.
Well, I said until 2011 because I included Libya as the final act.
And then therefore, how do you explain President Hollande as the leader of the West still intervening in Mali and elsewhere? Is that an example of
No, I think that does count, but I think, and I've been to the French Air Force College, and I like to speak to French diplomats and military officers and others when I can. And in fact, Nigel may choke on this, but my own philosophical influence, or one of them, a major one, is actually more continental in French than European, with Michel Foucault and others who ask uncomfortable questions and challenge how we think. There's a difference between how we react and the French react to Africa in particular, because our decolonization and the French decolonization look significantly different. The French haven't. They still have footprints on all those places, and so when they go to Mali, they're not saying, how do we get into Mali? They're saying, how do we beef up what is already in Mali and the political positive feelings that are there already? Blair was asked, well, why haven't you, he writes about it in his book, he said, people often ask why we haven't intervened in Zimbabwe, and up to a million people were probably starved by Mugabe over the last 15, 20 years, usually in a year or two leading up to the elections. And Blair's response, that's where he spoke about, it's got to be doable, and it wouldn't have been doable because of the former colonial relationship between us and the Zimbabweans, former southern Rhodesians. So the French situation is different to us, and I think it is interesting, Hollande's position. There's got to be a certain amount of that. Like any Prime Minister and President, if you're struggling domestically, there's nothing like a good small war to boost your... How much of the intervention is because he's motivated by humanitarian and liberal interventionism, and how much is he motivated by domestic considerations? So again, even there are lots of subtleties and things we have to think about.